Hi there, I'm Jack and I'm with Monique back at NAMM 2015. And we're back here with Matt Taylor. And if you remember in April, Matt was collared by the Jodcast to give an update on Rosetta. And so, hi Matt.
Hello. good to talk to you again.
Is there any update for the reader on Rosetta?
There's always an update with Rosetta. I can't think what's happened since. Well, if it was in April, it was shortly after we were experiencing issues with flying close to the comet. So we have completely thrown out our planned schedule. So we changed everything, the way that we were flying the mission, effectively. Whereas we were planning long-term in four-month chunks and saying we'll do this flyby in August and then we'll do this on that week. We've gone to trying to get as close to the comet as possible. That's it. That's the only goal, is to fly and fly in certain regions to see how we're interacting with the comet. So that's what's happened in that time, as well as, you know, the lander peeping up in June time period to say I'm awake.
Has there been any other information from the lander?
Unfortunately, not. I mean, we were having information when it first woke up. Then we were having a number of passes where it was communicating with us, but it was very sporadic. We didn't get a very stable link, and that was a problem, mainly driven, I think, by our distance, but also that the lander's not in a great orientation, as we knew from November. But in November, we were getting reasonable links, but that was when we were at 30 kilometres. Now, well, at that point, we were over 200 when we first heard from it. Now we're down to 150 kilometres from the surface, and now we're not hearing anything. So that's the concern at the moment as to why that's the case. There are a number of reasons why that could be the case. I think somebody quoted me yesterday saying it's very bad news because it's broken. It could be that it's broken, but there are a number of other reasons. It could just be the geometries that we're flying now, which may be similar but not exactly the same as the ones when we did get contact. Possibly it's moved as well. We just don't know. And that's the thing, to be honest with you, without being able to fly that close to really see and, like, really go, right, we can see it, so we know where it is, it's oriented in the same way, and we're still not communicating. That's the only way we'll be able to tell what's wrong with it, but we can't. We're too far away at the moment, so we're just piecing things together.
So you mentioned that you can't get too close to the comet right now. So what are the reasons behind that?
It's mainly driven by the star trackers. So basically we have these star tracker devices that have to spot a certain amount of stars to accurately point the spacecraft. So they're our main navigation in terms of pointing. And as soon as they start getting confused, we have a problem with accurate pointing. And then you get to the situation which we did in March, where the spacecraft couldn't point accurately because it lost star trackers and it starts to drift slightly. And then we were losing contact of the high-gain antenna with the Earth. So that's a problem. Yeah. And then it goes into another. We have safe modes, which are safe by definition. Like New Horizons had a safe mode. They're called safe modes for a reason. If you put the spacecraft in a situation where it can't point properly, the star trackers can't see, you go in what we call the survival mode, where it tries to start scanning for the Earth with the high-gain antenna. And you really don't want to put it. You've basically lost the spacecraft
like
in deep space.
Scenario.
So and you don't. It can do that. It's designed to do that, but we've never tested it. It's basically an emergency situation. So we try to avoid putting it in that situation. So now we're stepping back from the comet, so we don't have as much dust around and noise on the star tracker. So we still can use the star trackers. So that's the trade-off. Distance versus safety, as it were.
And so in the next few months, what's the plans for towards the end of the mission with Rosetta?
Well, I mean, we're about to approach perihelion. We're probing different regions in terms of trajectories to say, well, we're in terminator orbit at the moment. Not actually in orbit. We're flying arcs in the terminator so that, you know, the plane between the sunlit side and the dark side. We're looking to see whether we should go a little bit on the night side to see if that means we can get closer, because we know on the day side, so off the terminator on the day side, we have to go further away. So this is how we're doing. It's kind of like, if we go here, then this is how we can get closer or further away. We're seeing the reaction of the star trackers to the environment. We're also studying what the star trackers are seeing. So we've repointed the spacecraft to compare the camera with the star tracker to really say, well, why are we seeing this with the camera and the star trackers are seeing this? To just get us a better feel for how to fly around the comet. And that'll mean we'll get a better idea for maybe planning different things in the future. So, well, maybe we'll do this. We will be flying an excursion in October time. So we go hundreds of kilometres away from the comet, up to 1,000, maybe 1,500, because we're trying to find one of the plasma boundaries. So I'm trying to see if we can cross maybe a bow shock. So that's one thing we'll do in October for definite. But then we'll come back and fly particularly, you know, again, get close, maybe fly slightly different trajectories. It's all based on what we're learning now by trying different things and studying the, because it's all on the star tracker at the moment. It's really saying, what can we do that doesn't get us into a bad situation or risk the spacecraft? What are the capabilities? And it's something we didn't envisage to be doing. So to be honest with you, when we were doing some of the science operations planning last year, we were looking at what we were worried about, not detecting any dust at all with a dust detector. So, you know, it's one of these things that you can only preempt so many things when you're doing something as exploratory as we have done. So you can prepare as much as you can, but then sometimes that's part of the exploration, is that it's not what you thought it would be.
It's all new territory, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I describe it as when I was young, there used to be a problem with British Rail that they had the wrong kind of leaves on the rail. So they had to, during autumn, there were leaves on the rail, but they had the wrong kind of leaves, which meant that some of the trains couldn't move. And so maybe this is the wrong kind of dust. We were expecting dust, but this dust is more problematic than other dust.
Okay. So you mentioned in your talk that it's now been extended to September 2016.
Yes.
So is that kind of new timeline, it meant that there's more avenues for science that you can explore?
I think once you've moved past a spacecraft nominal mission, we can be more daring. So maybe then we start saying, well, it's worth taking the risk to do this, because we've done, you know, if we get to the end of the nominal mission in December this year, we would have gained a lot of knowledge on how to fly the spacecraft and done a lot of science. So maybe we'll change certain things. Certainly by 2016, hopefully, again, this is another ongoing discussion, how long that cloud of dust will hang around. It's not particularly symmetrical around perihelion. It may not simply evaporate, so we won't have the same approach in terms of dust environment as we did when we came towards perihelion. All these things we've got to consider, but definitely once we get towards August, September time, we know that we'll be able to get closer and closer to the comet. So that's the key thing there for me, is this spiral in is very scientifically interesting, because we can't get that close at perihelion now. We're at 150 at Terminator now. By the end of this week, I think we'll get that close. Maybe we'll step down another 5 kilometres, but to be able to get very, very close will get us a taste of some of the really near surface coma that is very important and was one of the key measurements we wanted to make. And so the extension allows us to do some of that stuff that we can't do at the moment because we're so far away from the comet. There's still great stuff that we're doing. We're actually discovering things that we didn't. Again, the explorative nature of the mission is that it's the surprise of the unexpected. So that's what it's all about. Otherwise, somebody would have done this already.
It's all new. So one of the things you touched upon very briefly in your talk, which I found quite interesting, was what this mission offers for ground-based observations of comets in the future. Would you be able to talk a little bit more about
that? Yeah, actually, that's a key thing about the extension as well, because the extension period, I think from around November this year through March, April, is the best visibility of the comet from the ground. And again, you're on the edge of my knowledge from a ground-based astronomy point of view. But that was one of the key things, that we would stretch into the best viewing of the comet from the ground. And this is something I didn't highlight at all, really, is the key thing with having Rosetta alongside the comet for that long is that you've got all of these eyes trained on it from near Earth, so Hubble and other instruments are looking at it, and the ground-based instruments, that you can maybe, for want of a better word, calibrate all of the measurements from the ground with those in-situ measurements. And the fact that you're seeing some of this stuff, like the ALICE measurements of how some of the parent molecules are breaking up at very close to the comet, to then put that into context of what you're measuring from the ground and what you're measuring from near Earth as well, above the atmosphere. So getting rid of some of that those problems. But yeah, so you can kind of benchmark this comet with the ground-based, and then maybe, well, at least my consideration is you can then apply that to all the other observations that we made with ground-based. So it's that calibration of your ground-based measurements, which I think is very, very important, and allows even more people to interact with the mission and this comet.
So moving on with that, we saw the giant meteor furore around Rosetta and that. Is there any way that our, for example, amateur astronomers listening to this podcast could get involved with Rosetta? And
yes, it was I wouldn't say a poor advert, but I can't give you the specific link. But the best thing to do is if you Google, I think it's Rosetta ground based, there's a link on the JPL website, who's basically the JPL project. We have a US component. So my equal on the US side is Claudia Alexander. She's the project scientist for the US project. So she looks at the science of the US instruments, but she's also helped the amateur community. So Padma runs this effort. And so if you go via that website, once you've Googled it, there's also the Rosetta campaign, which is the pro side. That's how you get in. Colin Snodgrass, I would use the best person to contact on all of the ground-based activities, because for me, he's the go-to guy for all the ground-based from Rosetta. Mm-hmm. But that's where you get into it, and it's quite a lively group of people.
Well, it'd be great to hear from any of our listeners who have been involved so far, so get in touch if you have been. So, something you mentioned kind of in a lighthearted thing during your talk was about there's a lot of conspiracy theories about Rosetta. And I just wondered, do you have a particular favourite theory?
There are quite a few. I was trying to get another one because there was one video that had a squid swimming across the surface of the comet. There's a spaceship one. I like this, the one I was showing about how there's basically a whole video of somebody from the ESA had written this guy a letter because they were so adamant they needed this information to get out to the public that ESA were covering everything up. The comet's actually a spacecraft and you can see these buildings, etc. But there's some of the comments that you have where surely a space agency wouldn't pay 1.3 billion euros just to go to a comet. And you think, well, actually, yeah, that's what's happened. It's not just, yeah, and also, yeah, just to hide the fact that we're actually doing something else. It's science costs money. And yeah, that's actually cheap compared to some of the things you think we could have done.
Compared to other projects.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. And compared to just building a road, for instance, it's pretty good value for money, I think.
And you're landing on a comet.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, three times. Yeah. Well, four, if we count September, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know some people are very averse to talking about these conspiracy theories, but as I said, I think it means that we've touched so many people that they feel that they should engage that much. But, you know, so I look, it's fun, and that's why I talk about it.
But at least you're still capturing some people's imagination.
Yes, yeah. So that's what happens, as we saw with some press releases from this meeting as well. So yep. You're certainly capturing people's imagination.
Mm-hmm. No? Well, yeah, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And you're welcome back anytime.
Yeah, well, catch me anytime.
Yep, thank you.
Got nothing else to do. Thank you. Cheers.